Can you imagine spending 47 days at sea, encountering high waves, enduring relentless seasickness, sleeping 1 to 2 hours at a stretch, and waiting over 6 weeks for a hot freshwater shower? Let's hear from our next guest about the Atlantic Rowing Challenge that changed her life. I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today again by Laura Langton, who's an investment manager at JM Finn and a former guest on the series. When we last talked, she was preparing for the world's toughest row Atlantic Challenge. In January of this year, her team, Ace of Blades, completed the row over 3,000 miles in 47 days, 7 hours and 27 minutes. The team raised a total of £80,000 so far for charity, and their social media account chronicled their adventures and all of their high points and low points. I am thrilled to welcome Laura back here to tell us all about her adventure and to reflect on what a life-changing experience like that does to a person.
Welcome back, Laura. Great to see you here.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, huge congratulations on what an amazing achievement it was to complete the world's toughest row. We watch breathlessly as your team completed the challenge and remain in awe at your resilience and strength. And it's hard to even know where to begin now that you're back on dry land. But let's just start from the top. What are the words that come to mind now when you look back at this experience?
I think the main words are brutal and relentless. I think it's definitely, there's not going to be any issues with calling it the world's toughest row. And it was an incredible experience, but I don't think you can really prepare yourself for how difficult it is out there. And it doesn't just stop at nighttime. It doesn't just stop because you're not feeling great. You can't, moor up somewhere and just take a moment and take a breath to think about it. It's just continual sort of, this has happened, now what are we going to do? We had a few sort of lovely days, but then we had a lot of stormy weathers, like 30-foot waves that were just coming and coming. And it was like, okay, we're getting through this, but when will this end?
Well, let's start with the teams. So 4 of you in a boat. How many teams in total on this race?
So there were 39 teams that started the race, and then sadly, one gentleman passed away, so 38 finished.
Pretty much full complement finishing, though, but barring some unexpected event like that. Didn't look like from the pictures online that you saw many other teams on the water. At least it looked fairly desolate and lonely out there from your boat. So let's talk about your team. So 4 of you. And in the last podcast, we spoke about the preparation, the relentless preparation you were doing for this event and the team dynamics that you were building and the stresses you were deliberately putting yourself under. But let's talk about how the team experienced it. And maybe starting from the beginning, I understand there was some seasickness at the beginning and that kind of eased as time went on.
Yep. So the seasickness at the beginning was horrendous. And I have never been seasick before. So the advice was don't take any medication unless you know that you're a sufferer. So I started off thinking, it's fine. But we left La Gomera and then there was the hope that we'd have a sort of 48-hour weather window to get out and away from land. And I think that probably lasted for about 15 or 16 hours. It was quite foggy. So we lost sight of land within about 12 hours rather than maybe like the 24 to 36 hours that it normally takes. So I think that was quite confusing and all 4 of us really struggled with seasickness. We were all fairly militant with taking the medication as soon as we started suffering. But I think the sort of closing the door after the horse had bolted for me, definitely. But then I think that was just, it's just sort of working out how are you going to get through this. Actually, you don't have the luxury of just saying, I'm going to take the afternoon off because I don't feel very good, because that's just a huge stress on the rest of the team. As skipper, I don't really have the opportunity to just bow out and let the others take the strain. So yeah, that was quite a difficult one, but we were very strict to making sure that everybody took the medication every 4 hours, drinking a sort of liquid fuel rather than trying to eat solid food that was going to potentially make it worse, and then just building up so that we were all back to sort of full strength. I think I probably took the longest, but yeah, within a sort of 5 or 6 days, everybody was back to fairly physically fit.
And then initially it was planning, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. That was your kind of roster. I understand that changed a little bit in the middle, that you started doing 3 rowing at a time. So there may have been fewer breaks. And what was the sleeping like inside these tiny cabins? What was the longest sleep you got over these 47 days?
So the longest sleep was probably, I'd say, 2 hours. So we had to go on power anchor on day 30. So it's kind of etched in my brain because it was definitely the darkest day for me out there. So the power anchor is a parachute that you put out to hold the boat's position, but it basically just stops you from moving in the direction that you don't want to go in faster than you would do if you were trying to sort of fight it yourself. So we actually didn't go on to 2 hours on, 2 hours off for about the first 4 days or so because our auto tiller, which keeps the course, wouldn't work. So we were trying to lock off our steering for the first day and then just keep our course. That wasn't really working. We weren't really making any progress. So we moved to 2 hours on, 1 hour hand steering and 1 hour rest. Did that for about 24 hours and then moved on to trying to hold the auto tiller on rather than hand steering. So 2 hours rowing, 1 hour holding the auto tiller on and 1 hour rest. So we did that for about the first 3 or 4 days. And then just before we went on power anchor, we'd experienced huge waves again. And sort of the current was going in completely the wrong direction for us. And the winds were pushing us south when we needed to go west. So we're trying to fight against that in terms of the wave direction as well. So the auto tiller again wouldn't work. So we did 2 hours rowing, 1 hour hand steering, 1 hour rest, and rowed probably about 8 miles in 15 hours. It was horrendous. And as a crew, as skipper, I was looking around at the rest of the girls and just thinking, I don't think we've got any more hours of this in us. But if we're still battling, because you don't want to go on power anchor because you can't row at the same time. So you basically sat there at the mercy of the weather and the waves. But then we spoke to the safety officer and he said, it's not a failure, because I thought of its failure as in sort of giving up and just holding our position. He said, it's more of a tactical decision to rest up, refuel and be ready for when the opportunity arises that you can go with the weather and that you can make good progress. So instead of sort of killing ourselves to make no progress, we were, you know, having an opportunity that meant that we could get ourselves ready to make decent headway when the weather changed. So we were on power anchor for 6 hours, which meant that one of us was sleeping in the cabin whilst one was eating on deck, and then we'd switch over. So I think, yeah, probably got about 2 hours sleep, just myself in the cabin. And then Liz, who I'm sharing cabin with, she came and joined me for like the last hour or so. So I didn't quite sleep because it was so cramped in there. But yeah, so it was not a huge amount of sleep for the duration of the crossing. And when we were rowing three up, it was 2 hours on, 40 minutes off. So that was a fairly brutal regime, which I don't think the girls particularly thanked me for, because I was always an advocate of rowing three up when the weather was good so that we could make the best progress, and rowing three up when the weather was bad so that we could make headway and get through it. So I was always going, if you just chuck the other pair of oars in and keep going.
So you've kind of lived this experience of sleep deprivation and the effect it has on, I suppose, cognitive skills as well as just general energy and general mood. Talk to us a little bit about that. So obviously you did do some training with 24 hours awake and hiking in the dark, etc. But what is it like after a physically long extended period of this kind of sleep deprivation as well as a physical exertion?
I think it's fascinating because we all reacted very differently to it. One of the girls really struggled with hallucinations to the point where she had sort of forgotten what we were doing. And there was a conversation where I turned around and thought, we need to do something about this because you're not going to be able to continue. Another one of the girls like pulled her oars in and told me she was going to go get a mango from across the side of the ocean. I was like, no, put your oars back out. We're still rowing. So there was two of us that really struggled with it. And then that just meant that it was a little bit more pressure on the other two of us to be more alert about it. I didn't really struggle with the sleep deprivation as much, but I sort of trained myself to do the micro sleeping. So every opportunity I would be making sure that I could get at least sort of 20, 30 minutes, just even if it was on deck, just closing my eyes and just trying to plow through. But when you're out there, you sort of have to just do what you can. It's such a weird environment because there is nothing to break up what you see. The waves might be different, but you've still just got a huge, like a vast amount of blue. And wherever you look, there's no sort of defining feature. So all of a sudden, you're doing the same thing over and over again and sort of feeling like you're going a little bit crazy, because the only thing that tells you you're going the right direction is a tiny little screen on deck. So I think that was really interesting, especially seeing the variation of how each of us dealt with sleep deprivation and then the physical side of things. I knew it was going to be tough, but in terms of the physical strength that you need, especially with the size of the waves that we had, it was just a whole nother level.
That was certainly what us spectators watching your amazing social media manager and her coverage were bearing in mind. But what about mind tricks and other ways that you had of kind of overcoming that type of monotony? Because there must have been some. I know you had playlists been sent through by your supporters, and I'm sure you had all kinds of problems of the world that you discussed and solved on this journey. But what kind of mindset did you find made tolerating that more bearable?
I think it was really interesting because there were definitely times when you just sort of had to grind it out and you turn around to whoever you were rowing with and just say, how are we feeling? Are we chatting for the next hour, or are we sitting in silence? Are we, you know, having, shall I just chat at you, or do you want to just chat at me? And Kit, who I've known for since university, so for a long time, and we've rowed together for a fair amount, and she just knows me so well that she was just like, I'm just going to chat at you. I was like, yeah, no, it's fine. I probably won't have much to give back to you, but just know I'm listening. It's just sort of reading each other and being upfront and making sure that everybody is aware that just if you're quiet, it's not necessarily that you're in a bad mood. It might just be that you're taking it all in. And then we definitely just started making sure that we had targets for each of our shifts. So every 2 hours, we, like, the bare minimum we wanted to row was 5 nautical miles. So you could see that you were chipping away at it. And if I was in my second hour and I knew that I needed to get to a certain number to get my 5 miles in, I'd tell whoever just come on shift behind me that, you know, we were trying to push so that I could get my 5 miles. And it was like kind of individual targets, but working together so that, you know, you had a bit of a focus to make sure you're doing the right speed and that you were chipping away at things. But I think also, so one of our speakers died on the first day because the weather was so bad and I forgot to take it in, which is my problem. So that died on the first day. And even though I tried to nurse it back to health, there was no way of drying it out on our boat. And then the second one sadly died a death about 2 weeks before the end of the row. So for a long time, we didn't actually have any sort of outside noise or music. So the first 4 weeks, 5 weeks or so, we were able to, if it was a bit bad mood or people weren't really keen to be chatting, we could put some music on and bring the vibe a bit higher. But for the last 2 weeks, we really needed to work with each other to make sure that everybody was in a good place or as good a place as they could be, and that we were making progress.
And you spoke about putting on the power anchor. Is that the name of the device? Yeah, around day 30. And then some of these waves you encountered. So talk to us about some of the hazards, I suppose, that you encountered. And again, the mindset, like, did you think this is it? This is the end. This is going to, you know, tip us over. Were there any moments like that? Any other kind of unexpected setbacks?
So I never actually thought that we were going to capsize or that the boat was going to go over. And I don't know whether it was just wishful thinking. And also Kit, one of the girls, she was sort of terrified of capsizing. So I thought, if I give in and also say that I'm worried, it's going to cause a bit of issues on board. So I didn't actually ever feel unsafe or that I was in danger. It was sort of terrifying, but in an exciting way rather than terrifying in a scary way. But the first week, definitely, there were waves the size of 3-story townhouses that were coming towards you because you face towards the waves that are coming your way. So you can see exactly what's about to hit you. And there was definitely one that will forever be etched in my memory where the boat was basically tipped up vertically. And I could see this wave coming towards us. And I was thinking, oh, don't break, don't break, don't break. So that, you know, if it didn't break, we would just go over the top of it and it was fine. But it literally broke just at the tip and the whole wave came over and just swamped the boat. It obviously kicked off the auto tiller. So the boat span and was pinned down on the side so that we had to get everybody up to turn it. And I just remember thinking, that is possibly the biggest thing I've ever seen coming towards me. I was just thinking, we just have to trust that the boat is going to be able to deal with this. So there was a lot of those, and then sort of side sweepers where the waves would just come over the side of the boat. And those weren't so bad, but it's just, you would just ended up so salty by the end of your shift. It's just absolutely covered in salt, which meant sitting down in shorts and having the salt all over you was just horrendous. And then on Christmas Eve, Kit and Liz went into the water to clean the bottom of the boat because you get a lot of barnacles and sort of debris that builds up on the bottom of it, and that slows the boat down. So Kit was in the water at the time and she said to me, oh, just pull the dagger board up a second. And the dagger board, because there's no keel on the bottom of the boat, the dagger board provides stability. And it's meant to be about a meter and a half long. Pulled it up and it was this tiny little stump. And basically it had snapped off somewhere between us leaving and Christmas Eve, which is 11 days or so in. So for however long we'd been rowing without any stability with the boat, which is also why it spanned so easily, because there was no way of it being kept in the position that it was in. And then we had to row without a dagger board for the rest of the time. So we're on Christmas Day, we're saying, you know, all I want for Christmas is another dagger board. And it's the only thing that you don't have two of as well on the boat. So that was quite frustrating.
Oh, now we're going from the low points. Let's go to the high points. What were some of the truly magical moments that you enjoyed during the voyage?
Definitely the night sky will forever be the most incredible thing I've ever seen, especially when there was no moon, which we didn't have for the first three nights, just pitch black. And the stars, couldn't even imagine how many there are of them. And then seeing all the constellations. So we'd always come out and be like, and say hi to Orion's Belt, because you always knew you were going in the right direction if Orion's Belt was to the top right of you. So seeing that and like the Big Dipper and just being able to be, especially when the waves were a bit calmer, is just so serene. And, you know, there was times we just sat there thinking, this is such a privilege to be able to be out here. You know, it's not a given that just because you signed up, you can be here. And that just because you get to the start line doesn't necessarily mean you're going to finish and get through it all. So that was absolutely incredible. And there was two shooting stars that myself and Beth saw. We were rowing together. And they started from the left-hand side of the sky, went all the way over to the right-hand side and left like a trail of gold dust behind them. It was like it was a film or a cartoon. It was that beautiful. And I just thought, this is amazing. And even describing it will never do it justice. We weren't overly gifted with wildlife, but having sort of six or seven whales playing around us whilst we were rowing along was quite fun. And the first night there was about 50 or 60 dolphins, which made the first night, which was pretty horrendous, fairly magical, seeing them all just playing and sort of jumping out of the water. And I think also just kind of coming into English Harbour in Antigua was just amazing. And we finished about 20 or 30 minutes behind another crew, the Tidewaves, who we got on really well with in La Gomera and had sort of been chasing them down and overtook them. Then they overtook us. And we were sort of parallel for a long time. So we were raiding each other for the last 4 days. And so ending like our campaign and our challenge so close to another amazing female crew, seeing all of our friends and family, and just, yeah, that will forever be etched in the most amazing memories.
I'm going to ask a few quick fire questions now, just to kind of, because I have so many on my mind, but I just want to ask you. So what did it teach you about yourself?
It taught me that I'm definitely a lot more emotional than I thought I was. I'm a lot more resilient. I'm very much a sort of, I can bend myself to support the rest of the team. I think there was a lot of times when my teammates were having difficulties or having really struggling. And I was like, right, this is my job as skipper to make sure they're all okay. Yeah, I think that there's so much. I personally have the challenge to see how far I can push myself. And I just think that, you know, I learned so much in terms of leading a team, supporting a team. I made a lot of mistakes that I think actually, if I had my time again, I would do things slightly differently. But then you don't know what you don't know. So being out there gave me a huge amount of information, and making sort of quick fire decisions, just utilizing whatever the resources you have at your fingertips. So, yeah, that was amazing.
Well, you kind of answered a little bit of the teamwork question, but I suppose you did say, would you do it again? Is this an experience you would repeat?
I wouldn't do it again, but I wouldn't go back and not do it, if that makes sense. It's 2.5 years of preparation, plus sort of 2 months away from work, 2 months out of the UK, 7 weeks away from home. And the one thing about this that I definitely learned is it's possibly the most selfish thing that you can do, because my fiance, for example, he had to go through the whole journey with me, but he doesn't get the glory of saying, I've rowed across the Atlantic. You know, he had to go through, he experienced basically all of the highs and lows that I experienced, because although we didn't have signal constantly, if I was having a bad day, I'd WhatsApp voice note. And then if I was having a good day, I'd send him another one. And then when we did manage to set up, you know, rig up the signal, he'd get them all in one go. So he'd go through this emotional roller coaster of listening to me and everything that I was going through. And he didn't know whether or not I was okay at the time that he was listening to them. So you know, I just don't think I could put him and my mum and my family and work and everybody else through it again. But it was definitely worth it and amazing and super proud of the achievement that we have.
Very small but practical question. What did you miss most? And what was one of the first things you did when you hit dry land? Besides the people, connecting with the people, small practical luxuries.
Definitely a clean shower. I cannot explain how being salty, I was so surprised at how you were never clean. Although you were never particularly dirty, you were never clean and dry. And just things like being able to wash your hands and then dry them and then have dry hands was just the most incredible thing when we were on land. But yeah, I definitely sat in the shower for about 20 minutes because I just wanted to wash my hair over and over again.
It seems like one of life's very simple pleasures indeed. And then now that it's done and you're on the other side of this and we're having this discussion of the amazing experience, do you experience life in the same way since? Do you see life, its experiences, things a little differently?
I think it's a tough one because I've not been on land for a month yet and life just came bouncing back exactly how it was before. Just, it seems like a surreal dream what we achieved and what we did. And I think that it's going to take a while to actually sink in and say, you know, I did that. And I think that's when you start chasing the highs that you experience when you're out there. I definitely appreciate everything that people have done for me a lot more than I think you just take it for granted that it's always going to be, you know, people just do it because, you know, your friends or your family or whatever it is. The ease of communication, the ease of just being able to find things out. I mean, being out there and having a conversation and thinking, which actor was it that was in that film? And then realizing that you can't work it out and you have no way of finding out the answer. And also just, we followed the race for 2 or 3 years before we started, before we did the race this year. And you're always able to see the app and you're able to see what all the fleet were up to and hear the stories and everything else. And then you're out there and it's so isolating because you have no communication with other people or no easy communication. You can't see where the rest of the crews are. You've just got to hope that what you're doing is the right thing. So I think actually just realizing how lucky you are to be able to send messages and receive emails and just have that wealth of information at your fingertips is definitely something you just take for granted, which I no longer do.
So what advice would you give to somebody else tempted to undertake a similar challenge? Because you obviously prepared very well, but maybe not for every eventuality. What would be your words of advice for the next generation of rowers?
I would definitely say that you need to get the history of your boat and fully understand everything on board to the nth degree and also check the suitability of it. I mean, we were really fortunate to be fully funded, but all of our money came towards the end of our campaign, or the majority of our money came towards the end of our campaign. And so actually, there's a lot of upgrades that we would have done or should have done to the boat before. We should have trained with it. And all the equipment on our boat did it 3 times before. And so we were the fourth crossing, but we had much bigger waves, arguably much faster winds. So we came up against a lot of issues that possibly the previous crews never experienced. And also just getting as much information as you can do from all of the previous crews. I mean, ocean rowers love talking about ocean rowing, so you're never going to be short of somebody to chat to. But just fully understanding it all, I think I definitely took for granted that the boat was just the same as every other boat, which is just, they're not. But really as well, just getting as much time out on the boat as possible. I think people think that it's more of a physical fitness side of things, and you're never going to be able to emulate what you have out in the Atlantic. But being able to just get to grips with sleeping and eating and just being on board, using the water maker, which broke for us, which was really frustrating. And we were drinking, turned out to be rust in our water, but we were drinking sort of salty, rusty water for the last sort of 3 weeks. But that was just something that happened. We got through it and we managed to fix it to the best of our ability with the equipment on board. But we were really fortunate to have been, you know, had forced ourselves to make sure that we knew how that works. So there's just so much to know. And just diving in and getting to grips with it is the best way to be successful with it.
Well, as a runner, someone who's done like probably something that is endurance related, but not nearly as much as that, I do know there have been tears. They have been beautiful tears because it's the tears of pushing yourself to the limit and knowing. And I'm sure there were many tears on your boat at times. We haven't talked about them, but I can't imagine there would not be. And there's no one to see you anyway out there. So what does it matter? But just now, finally, just in terms of bringing this back to the professional world, given that's where we met, and I'm sure you've been an inspiration to many with this resilience, this endurance, anything that you've taken from this that you'll take into your world as a financial advisor?
I definitely think that having a good team around you is really important. I think that I was really fortunate to have three women who were incredibly supportive, backed me, because fundamentally the decision sort of fell at my door. If I said that we were doing something as skipper, it meant that we would have to do it. But I was really fortunate that we didn't have any major disagreements, that there was no real tension on board. Before starting the challenge, we had agreed that we would have robust conversations and that anything that was said out there, we would make sure that we waited to say it at an opportune time, which was normally there in the morning. And hopefully it would have passed if it was something that was just a little bit of a bugbear. But if it was something serious we needed to raise, we always said, it's not personal, it's to do with the row. So you put all of your sort of ego and sort of emotions to one side, and you just pull together to make sure that you're doing what's best for the
Well, thank you, Laura. I am even more awestruck now having spoken with you than I was based on following your challenge remotely. Thank you so much for coming here, for what you've contributed to humankind in terms of pushing limits, for the lessons you have shared with us here. And thank you for the courage to undertake such a challenge and to instill such inspiration in all of us.
Thank you.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear from more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all of our content on the 50 Faces Hub, where you'll find a library of role models, resources, and other solutions to enhance your career.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.